Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson. I'm going to kick us off this morning with an Easter-themed item from yesterday's Today show. Mary Louise O'Donnell attended a reenactment of The Passion of Christ, which was staged in the fields and hillside around Palace Green in County Limerick, before moving to a grotto in the village. Having started at 9 p.m. on Holy Thursday evening, it eventually finished up at 4:30 a.m. on Good Friday morning. Despite having had very little sleep, Mary Louise came into studio hours later to tell Sean O'Rourke all about it.
In we went to the chapel and in came, you're not going to believe this, the 11 to 13 high priests singing in Hebrew, in tune, in Hebrew, and Caiaphas pulling the Christ into this chapel in Palace Green and saying to us, and I'm sitting there with the rest of the congregation, you know who you are. You know why you're here. You know why he's here, speaking lies, preaching lies. He's calling us a painted sepulchre and telling us that we've the heart of dead men. Why do you follow him? Look at the state of him. And the Christ, Jesus of Nazareth, was obviously very dishevelled and on his knees with chains and the Roman soldiers around him. Why are you so silent? Because that's what happened, you see. Caiaphas got more mad and more mad because Christ wouldn't defend himself. Are you the Son of God? Are you a king? What are you a king of? Who are you a king of? Where are your followers now? Do you know, Shauna nearly stood up and said, hold up a minute, Caiaphas, the Jew is wronged. It was so magnificently done. And then he said, are you the Son of God? Tell us. And of course, Jesus said, yes, I am. Guilty. Pull him out. And then we pulled him out into the grotto. And the grotto has a natural amphitheatre in front of it. And it was like going to an open air opera. And around the grotto were these huge big urns, about 15 to 16 urns placed around with massive fires. Massive crackling fires with the smoke going everywhere up against the hill and all around, you know, and there was Mary and Martha and Mary of Bethany and Magdalene and Elizabeth and Veronica all in a tableau. And I looked out over the whole vista and what did I see in the distance but the Celtic crosses, the grey Celtic crosses and this cackle and fire. I thought I was at art and drama and a biblical story that was the most uplifting I'd ever been at.
The inexhaustible Mary Louise O'Donnell has heard on Fridays Today with Sean O'Rourke. The verdicts in the Anglo trial received lots of media coverage in the latter half of this week. So how did the international media and markets respond to the news? The Financial Times ran it as a front page story. And on Friday morning, Ireland correspondent with that newspaper, Vincent Boland, spoke to Cathal McQuilla on Morning Ireland.
I think media interest was fairly intense, actually. This has always been a very big story. The Anglo-Irish Bank created, it was, if you like, the 64 billion euros that it cost the Irish taxpayer to prop up the Irish banks, and in particular the 34 billion that it cost to prop up Anglo, and that ultimately, you know, it was entirely useless. That was the figure that was heard around the world back in 2008 and 2009. And I think that since then, there's a lot of international interest in how this happened and why it happened and who was involved and how could such an enormous event happen in such a small country.
I'm looking at your page one headline yesterday saying face of Irish crisis cleared of loan fraud beside a big picture of Seanan Fitzpatrick. That looks bad for Ireland Inc. now, doesn't it?
Perhaps it does. I actually think that the trial and the way it was conducted and the, if you like, the verdicts as well reflect very well on the Irish legal system, for example. I mean, look, there's no doubt that the collapse of Anglo, the collapse of the banks and everything involved, that was terrible for Ireland's reputation abroad. And the country is still recovering. I think that a lot of people outside Ireland will see the trial and the verdicts and the way it was conducted as part of the, if you like, the healing process, the emerging from this destruction of its reputation.
Infuriating. And I emphasise, Seanan Fitzpatrick is innocent of the charges that he faced.
Yes.
But in other words, in terms of process, in terms of regulation or lack of it, in terms of legislation effective or lack of.
But
Are the markets interested? Are they going to be impressed? Are they going to be worried by what's emerged over the last couple of days and weeks?
I think that what the focus of the markets is entirely different. Most investors, when they look at Ireland now, they see lots of cheap assets. That's why they're putting lots of money into Ireland, into buying stakes in banks or in Irish companies or property or whatever it is. And they're not looking to the past, certainly. So in that sense, the Anglo trial is not going to have any bearing on current and immediately future market sentiment towards Ireland.
Vincent Boland of the Financial Times on Friday's Morning Ireland. Staying with that story later on Friday, Dermot MacDonald of the Irish Independent came into the Today studio to discuss the verdicts with Sean O'Rourke. Towards the end of the interview, she spoke about the possible implications on Sean Quinn and his family.
Well, a member of the Quinn family attended every single day of the Anglo trial, almost maintaining a watching brief, you know, whether it was Sean Quinn's son-in-law, who's a solicitor, Niall, or another member of the family. And clearly they had an interest in the evidence being led in the criminal proceedings to see what benefit they could have for their civil case. Bit of a setback, I think, you know, really for them, in so far as the jury decided that the loans in this case to them were lawful, because it suggests that there was a legitimate commercial basis to them. The state had been quite desperate, certainly towards the end of this trial, to make sure that the Quinn loans were captured by illegality. But it will be very, very hard to predict. Look, I mean, if you think the Anglo trial was long, we're looking at least 9 months of litigation in the civil courts between Quinn and all of those other cases. But I suppose one of the questions I asked myself this morning and expressed in the pages of the Irish Independent was, you know, let's go back and look at this. Here was Sean Quinn, you know, and I've no doubt, absolutely no doubt, that his motivations were sincere to build up wealth and enduring wealth for his children and his grandchildren. But he built up a secret stake in Anglo Irish Bank. A secret stake. The media and market rumours, he didn't go and buy the shares openly on the market. He didn't declare his hand, so to speak. And the first time this was formally confirmed, despite market rumours, was at the Ardbourne Hotel in Navan on September 11th, I think, 2007, where he said, I've got 24% stake in the bank.
And he told this to Shawnee Fitz and Drum.
Shawnee Fitz and David Drum. And interestingly, David Drum was instructed by the board to go immediately to Pat Neary, who doesn't appear to recall the meeting the next day and doesn't appear to recall David Drum telling him anything about the 24% stake. I think he said he was surprised to get a call from David Drum. He thought it might have been for a personal matter. Michael Higgins, senior counsel for Sean Fitzpatrick, said, what do you mean? You know, was it kind of like troubles at home or inquiring about where to go on holidays? And Pat Neary said, well, yes, it could have contemplated that, you know. And it was kind of one of those moments of the trial where you kind of wanted to throw rocks. But in any event, this was disclosed, and what was Sean Quinn's problem? There was a fatal attraction really between himself and the bank, because various monies were sent to the Quinn Group. Were they working capital? Were they to fund the CFD position? But in any event, almost 2 billion was lent to the Quinn Group. And that, you know, you've some sympathy, I have to say, for the directors of Anglo, and indeed the state, when it later had to try and come and deal with this issue, because nobody invited Sean Quinn to build up that big bet. And now we have a scenario where he is going into court armed with these verdicts and ostensibly could win.
Dermot MacDonald talking to Sean O'Rourke on Friday. The situation in Ukraine also continued to dominate the headlines this week. On Monday's News at 1, we heard from journalist Roland Oliphant, who hours earlier had witnessed the storming of a police station in Horlikva.
Essentially, a mob of, I'd say, you know, several hundred pro-Russian separatists, equipped mostly with stones, sticks, fire extinguishers, you name it, but no firearms that I saw, basically laid siege to and eventually stormed and now have control of the police station in this town. It looks like another one of these kind of coordinated seizures of police stations that's happening across this region of Ukraine.
And you've left that town now for fear for your safety, and other journalists as well.
Yeah, that's right. Initially, we were allowed to work relatively unmolested, and at some point, it simply turned very, very ugly. I was manhandled. Some colleagues, they almost lost their camera. It's pretty much destroyed. It got to the point where it was a question of simply getting out. They hear your press, and once they realize you're not Russian press, they assume you're either American spies or you're Americans spreading false information. They're not really aware of any other country existing in the world.
The Russian Foreign Ministry are saying today that there are no Russian agents in eastern Ukraine. They're denying that they're coordinating this at all. You're saying there, though, it has the clear appearance of a coordinated event.
It seems to be. I mean, the way this all started the other day with several police stations seized, it's always police stations that seized. I haven't seen any of the so-called little green men today, but I have seen elsewhere in this region very well-armed men who carry themselves and act and behave like professional soldiers. They're very, very different to the kind of civilian mob, if you will, that we saw in action today. So there is certainly coordination going on. In that sense, it's similar to what we saw in Crimea a month ago. So yeah, I think it's reasonable to say there are grounds to believe there's Russian planning behind this.
Roland Oliphant, Moscow correspondent for the Daily Telegraph, talking to Jonathan Clinch on Monday's News at 1. On Thursday, in a deal brokered by the US and the EU in Geneva, Russia and Ukraine agreed on a pact to de-escalate the situation. On Friday's Morning Ireland, DCU lecturer Dunico Bachoin gave his assessment of the agreement. Colin McQuilla asked him if it's likely to bring stability to the region.
Well, that's the aspiration, but the agreement is very, very short in detail. It's just over 200 words. So, you know, when you compare it to something like the Good Friday Agreement, which ran for many, many pages, there's no detail on how this is to be achieved. What I'm worried about is that Russia has said up until now that they have no powers over these people in eastern Ukraine, that they're acting completely on their own initiative. So when they talk about all illegal armed groups must be disarmed, the big question is by whom? And they're leaving it very vaguely to the OSCE, this large security organization, which hasn't a lot of teeth and certainly won't be armed. So they're going to these armed groups monitoring and saying, please disarm, and they don't. It's not quite clear who will enforce it.
Yeah, you can't help but thinking of the beginnings of our own peace process where people are, as President Obama we heard a few minutes ago, are openly sceptical, are openly dubious about the good intentions of the other side. But you've got to start somewhere. Now, the question is the goodwill there or enough of it on all sides?
That's the problem. And again, going back to our own Good Friday Agreement since the day that's in it, you know, we had two sovereign governments who were committed to banging heads, you might say, in Northern Ireland and bringing people together. The problem is that the external actors in Ukraine are not on the same page as the London and Dublin governments were all those years ago.
President Putin is, as you say, very much holding the position that he's entitled to intervene in Ukraine if he wants to. And
very
said
much
so openly on the very day this deal was signed.
Exactly. He did a marathon session on TV, ran for 4 hours. He does this every year of kind of meet the public. But the questions are very choreographed and orchestrated in advance. And he was asked a number of questions and he came up with some very frank answers. One is that he doesn't really recognise Ukraine as a legitimate entity. He kept talking about the boundaries being artificial, that in the 1920s, eastern Ukraine had been part of Russia. That's very worrying. He, as you said, reserved his right to use force in Ukraine if the situation deteriorated. There was even, admittedly, it was somewhat jocular, a question from the audience about Alaska. Of course, Alaska had been part of Russia until the 1860s and had been signed over as almost like a Crimea-type arrangement in the 1860s. And someone asked, will we take Alaska back? And he said, oh, no, don't get too hasty. We already have enough cold areas.
From Friday's Morning Ireland. It can be easy sometimes to lose sight of the human cost in a political crisis. On Monday's News at 1, however, we were reminded of how the most vulnerable in society are often the ones who are impacted most. Adi Roach is CEO of Chernobyl Children Ireland, and she came on the programme to talk about how dozens of children in Ukraine have had their heart surgery operations suspended due to the insecurity in the region.
Well, right now, at this present moment, about 60 of our children who are on a waiting list, who are expecting to have their surgeries, are now, unfortunately, their lives are dangling in the balance, and we're also having to question our next mission, which is due in about 4 weeks' time, where we fly in cardiologists and their entire equipment, whole medical schools to put in training systems. All of that is in a state of abeyance because of the unfolding situation. So to be honest, this is a kind of a devastating development for us. I mean, we're getting minute-to-minute accounts from the hospital, and yesterday in consultation with our own surgical teams, which is an international team, and with the local doctors in Kharkiv, they're saying that the situation is tense, it's volatile, it's close to collapse and chaos. But unfortunately, it is the most vulnerable children waiting for life-saving surgery. Without the surgery, they cannot live without the surgery. They will die without the surgery, and they are not going to lose their lives because of bullets, but simply because of nationalistic egos, which are preventing these children from receiving treatment. This Chernobyl Heart Cardiac Program has been one of our most successful initiatives in the 30 years that we've been working. Almost the Chernobyl anniversary, the 28th anniversary is actually next week as it happens, and this is one of our most tangible programs where you see these children who are born with multiple holes in the heart, and our surgeons go in funded by the people of Ireland, and they carry out literally miracles on the lives of these children. And it is devastating for us to have to make this decision, because these are surgeons that are used to going into war zones. In fact, some of them are you know, out in Africa at the moment. They travel all around the world, giving of their time for free to do these surgeries to help to save children's lives. And these are not, you know, faint-hearted guys, but they just feel the security and safety issues are too volatile. And of course, the hospital now is running out of supplies, they're running out of food, and there is, you know, nobody actually mentioning what is the humanitarian crisis around all of the madness that is currently happening throughout the whole of eastern Ukraine. And I'm hoping that sanity will prevail, that our politicians will do the right thing. Eamon Gilmore, I have great faith in his capacity to intervene at this level for us. I'm hoping everybody will rally around and that our surgeons' bags are packed. We're ready to go, but only in the event that it is safe.
A.D. Roach has heard on Monday's News at 1. The prestigious Giro d'Italia cycling race is due to come to Ireland next month. Paul Kimmage has written extensively about drug use in the sport, and on Wednesday he spoke to Sean O'Rourke about his reservations about the race coming to Ireland. Sean was also joined on the line by local organiser Dara McQuaid.
What precisely are your reservations? Because it is, as I said, 16 years now since the Tour de France was here. Are there particular individuals that you prefer that they wouldn't darken our shores or doors?
Well, let's just take something that just happened 2 days ago in Paris-Roubaix. Some British fans were standing by the side of the road. There was a crash, and after the riders had got up and moved on and the race cavalcade had moved on, the fans noticed a vial of pills that had fallen from a racer's pocket during the crash. And they took the pills up and they proposed to send them to the UCI to have them analysed. Now, the point about it is this. Rather than being specific to any rider or individual, it's a general problem that still persists in the sport that hasn't gone away, despite what a lot of people would say with Lance Armstrong, and that still needs to be addressed. The sport has made some progress in that regard, but there's still more to be done.
Right. Dara McQuaid, clearly reservations there on Paul's part. What would you say to people who feel, look, this really shouldn't be coming to Ireland, north or south?
Well, I would say that the sport of cycling has done more in the recent years than any other sport probably in the world to, as you said, clean up its act. It's probably setting a gold standard in world sport terms, in terms of anti-doping. So we can be fairly sure that the vast majority of young riders that we're seeing here, when they do come to Ireland to race the Giro, will be racing clean.
Well, on the basis that that vial didn't contain Smarties that Paul was referring to in Paris-Roubaix, maybe there's a bit more progress to be made.
Well, I don't think any sport, or any walk of life for that matter, would claim to be populated by 100% honest, clean people. I mean, nobody's really saying that cycling is unlike any other sport in the world, 100% clean. But the fact remains that it's doing more than any other sport to ensure a fair playing field for the riders. And I certainly believe that the vast majority of riders in the current peloton are racing clean.
And later in the discussion, Paul and Dara gave their differing views on Lance Armstrong.
Well, let's just remind people that 4 years ago, you were the guy who was welcoming Lance Armstrong here with open arms.
I mean, at the time, Paul, so did the Tour de France welcome Lance,
exactly.
And so did the Giro.
I hold them all equally responsible for the mess the sport is
in. Yeah,
but
Paul, hold on.
From Wednesday's Today Show, another sports story which was in the news this week was the 25th anniversary on Tuesday of the tragedy at Hillsborough, in which 96 football fans lost their lives. Former Liverpool player and Irish international Ray Houghton, who was on the pitch that day, spoke to Sean O'Rourke on the Today Show on Tuesday.
You know what? We don't hear about the heroic stories what happened that day. We still haven't. And there's been no recognition to the Liverpool fans. I went to a funeral of a fireman who his instincts took over, who was actually in the Lippens Lane and got himself out, went back in to help others, and unfortunately got caught up in the crush. I don't know if it was the second or the third time he'd gone back in to help people. So these people have not been recognised for their efforts and their heroic efforts on the day. We see sportsmen in England getting knighthoods for doing their job as sportsmen. You know, ladies getting, they're becoming dames and whatever. And we don't hear about the recognition, and haven't heard any recognition in 25 years for heroic work that was done by Liverpool fans, breaking up hoardings on the side of the pitch to make stretchers to carry the injured and in some cases the dead. Don't hear about that. That's never been mentioned. I think it's an absolute disgrace.
What will you be doing yourself this afternoon just after 3 o'clock, Ray?
As I've done for the last few years, I'll be in a room in the house on my own watching the TV with a lump in my throat and a TMI, particularly when I hear the 96 names being read out. People who went to watch a sporting event and should never have lost their lives.
There was a piece in the Financial Times yesterday that said Hillsborough was a catalyst which led to the transformation of British football. Would you say the football culture is totally different now to what existed in 1989?
Well, I'm sure it is, but also, though, should it have taken the tragedy to make the change? You know, that's the long and the short of it. Should it have taken 96 people to lose their life to change what everyone would have said at that time was wrong in football? Yeah, there was a few mindless idiots around, but did we really need to put fencing up for people to, you know, to go to a sporting event to watch football matches? My wife was there that day behind the fence. My brother was there that day behind the fence, as a lot of my friends. And I've got a lot of anger. I had a lot of anger that day when I seen it on the TV, and I've still got a lot of anger now about it. Absolutely ludicrous how we treated fans back in that time.
Ray Houghton, as heard on the Today Show on Tuesday. Another sporting event which ended in tragedy was also remembered on the airwaves on Tuesday, exactly a year after the Boston bombing. Katrina Perry met up with brothers Paul and JP Norden and JP's fiancée Jackie Webb. As we heard on Monday's Morning Ireland, the two brothers each lost a leg and Jackie still has shrapnel embedded in her body from the bombing.
The explosion was going off. I was being pushed forward. And I remember just thinking, like, this cannot be happening. We're in Boston. Like, there's not bombs that happen here. And we're at the marathon of all places. And I remember being really scared. And then I remember I had rings on, metal rings, and they were burning into my fingers, and I couldn't get them off.
When I came to, I saw that my leg was off. And then right away after, though, like, someone did run over, a former military, and he said, I'll be all right. He just told me, like, lay back, and then I asked him to, like, throw water on my back because, like, my back was burning.
I thought I got punched. I didn't know what happened, like, right in the beginning. And then when I thought about it, like, I tried to get up at this leg first, and I looked down and it was gone because I couldn't get up. I didn't know why I couldn't get up. And then I knew it kicked in, that, you know, that a bomb went off. When I looked down, my pants were on fire, and I was just putting them out, and my shirt up here was on fire.
You could see, like, the bone and the tissue. And I remember looking at it once, and I was like, I'm not looking back down there. This incident didn't define us. It is who we are now because we have scars, and there is results from it, but just hopefully get back to life.
From Katrina Perry's report on Monday's Morning Ireland. Monday's Live Line opened with a call from Caroline Sloan, a mother who told Joe about the tragic death of her 14-year-old daughter, Emma, who died on O'Connell Street a week before Christmas after she had a severe allergic reaction.
Joe, we went into Chinese buffet for a meal, for a pre-Christmas meal. And Emma ate satay sauce, and after a couple of minutes, Emma said her lips were starting to tingle. So we left, we paid the bill, and we left. And by the time we got around the corner, she was gasping for breath. And we went into a nearby chemist and asked for a pen for her, and we were refused. So we left the chemist, and I ran in to get the car. The car was parked in Arnott, and we crossed over, and she was waiting for me at the lights. She couldn't breathe. So when I went in to get the car, Susan, my sister, was with us. She rang an ambulance, and I had to come back down out of the car park. Susan rang me to say she was after collapsing. And the last words she said to Susan, well, I'm not going to make it. She knew, God love her, she was dying.
And between the time that you ate the satay sauce, which is peanuts, but by the time that Emma ate the sauce and you got around to O'Connor Street, as you said, How long did that take, Caroline? How long was the...
Well, from the time she ate the sauce, Joe, to the time she died, it took 15 minutes.
Oh, my God.
20 minutes, sorry, 20. We left the restaurant and we were in the chemist at 10 to 7. And by the time the fire brigade got to her at 5 past 7, she was dead.
And when Dublin Fire Brigade arrived, did they carry EpiPens?
They did. They done everything, Joe, I have to say, between them and Temple Street. I know she died, but I'll be forever grateful. They were nearly an hour. They tried to get her back. They worked on her, and they didn't give up till the very, very end. But I'm a mother, Joe, and I know she was gone before the fire brigade even got to her.
Caroline Sloan, as heard on Monday's Liveline. Another family who have recently lost a loved one are the Mangan family from Terenure in Dublin, whose mother Peggy Mangan, you might remember, died last September after she wandered off in a state of confusion. Peggy suffered from Alzheimer's, and her family have now set up the Peggy Mangan Foundation. Brenda Donoghue met up with her daughters for Wednesday's Mooney just before they handed over a search and rescue dog called Max to the Civil Defence. Before doing so, they remembered their mum, Peggy.
My mum went out for a walk with Casper went for her normal walk, came home and then went out for another walk for whatever reason, took a different route and kept going and ended out over the north side. And obviously after some time, my dad got concerned and went up to the guards. We were contacted and we all took to our different directions to try and bring her back home and started asking everybody and anybody that could help, took to Facebook with pictures, which was great because we got some information back from that. Continued late into the night and organised then for people to meet up the next day. And we continued on day and night to try and find her.
Now, your mum was very young. What age was she?
She was 67 when she died. Yeah, she was very young to have Alzheimer's. She had it for the 5 years and slowly took her away from us.
So how worried were you when she didn't come back, say, after an hour or two? Did you automatically go, we have a problem here?
Yeah, well, my dad had contacted the neighbours on the road and that just in case she had popped in there for a cup of tea or something. And then in the afternoon, he went up to the guards. And then we just literally got out on foot and started walking, looking for her and kind of trying to get it out there to as many people as possible just to keep an eye out. And that was it. Like, I mean, it was just friends, family and volunteers, like the people over the north side. They were absolutely fantastic. Like, we'll be forever indebted to them for the help they gave us at that time.
Casper was with her, a family dog or a horror dog, or tell me about Casper.
Well, Casper would have originally been my dog. Mam would have been the one that got lumbered with him when we went on holidays, and she just became so attached to him. She used to miss then when I took him back, so we just said that he'd stay with her, and obviously the boys, my kids, knew where he was so we could go and visit. They just were great companions, and he literally, I mean, as we know, done whatever he could for her.
Louise and Orla, I'm sure your mum is up there and she's looking down going, nice one, girls. What do you think?
Oh, well, I do hope so. Yeah.
And Casper, I'm sure he'd be delighted as well to know there's a little buddy down there helping out.
Today's a bittersweet day for us, but we do hope, you know, that Max will do great work and another family won't be in the same position that we're in now today.
From Brenda Dunhu's report on Wednesday's Mooney. All this week on Morning Ireland, reporter Keane McCormick has been travelling around the country talking to potential voters in advance of next month's election. On Monday, he visited the International Resource Centre in Tralee. We're told that 11% of voters in Kerry are immigrants, and if they've been living here since September, they're entitled to vote.
My name is Teresa Elumelu and I'm living in Tralee. I'm originally from Nigeria.
For you, what are the election issues here in Tralee?
My election, the issues I will have will be the direct provision issue, you know, the way the people are kept too long in the system. And another thing will be the unemployment situation in the country will be another issue for me.
My name is Christina Selina. I live in Tralee and originally I'm from Latvia.
Have you voted in Ireland before?
No, I haven't voted. This will be the first election.
You're registered to vote?
I am.
What are the important elements for you? What makes a good local politician?
For me, it's that they include every people, you know, that they don't, they don't only go for like Irish people votes, they would go as well for different ones.
Do you think politicians would just go for an Irish vote as you describe it?
In my opinion, I do think so, yes.
Why do you think this?
Because I recently heard that politicians have these strategics and they wouldn't enter states where there's a lot of immigrant population. It makes me feel that there is a discrimination, you know, that there is no social inclusion, that they really are not bothered to waste their time on us, but I think we should, because there's a lot of immigrants who are working, you know, they contribute to the country, to everything, you know, they contribute to communities. So our opinions and our voices should be listened to.
My name is Ali. Now I'm living in Tralee and I'm originally from Pakistan. I'm waiting for my status because I'm here in asylum system from 4.5 years and I'm still waiting for status. We are living in a hostel. This kind of accommodation is very stressful because with your children, one or two rooms, and that's not enough for a family.
This is your first time voting?
Yes.
Are you excited about it?
Of course, because I use my right and I hope something is changed in future for me, for my family, for all communities.
From Keane McCormack's report on Morning Ireland on Monday. On Friday, meanwhile, Keane reported from the Phoenix Project in Port Laois for people who are afraid they're about to lose their homes. One of those he spoke to was Josephine Cullen from Edenderry in County Offaly.
I was paying my mortgage up until 2012, and then my financial circumstances changed. I contacted the bank. They gave me a moratorium. Once I was out of moratorium, they basically told me that my mortgage then was unsustainable, wasn't suitable for mortgage to rent, so the only option is to sell.
You have to sell your house.
I have to sell my house, but houses in my area are, if they're selling, they're selling for very little. So no matter what, I will be homeless with a debt.
What age are your children?
My son is 10 and my daughter is 14. And I've been on my own 9 years, and like I said, I kept my mortgage up to date until 2012. But houses in the area are going for very little money. Phoenix Project have explained this to the bank and they still have said no, that is, unfortunately, it's the only option is to sell. Because I work part-time, I have been told that I wouldn't be eligible for mortgage for the rent allowance. I've also been told that in the area there is no emergency housing. So after paying mortgages for 20 years, if I am kicked out of my house, I've been told it's hostel or B&B accommodation for myself and my two children. I have applied for a council house and I was told that my application won't be considered until my house is repossessed. I really am in limbo. I'm sitting now in a house. I'm waiting to be taken to court. And then at that point, I honest to goodness do not know what's going to happen to myself and my two children. I'm on antidepressants.
From Keane McCormack's report on Friday's Morning Ireland. Indeed, there was a lot of talk in the airwaves this week about housing and repossessions. One such forum was Wednesday's late debate with Audrey Carvel. One of the guests on the panel was former Bank of Ireland CEO Mike Soden, who is now on the board of the Central Bank Commission.
Do you support repossessions?
I do. It has to be done, but it has to be done. It's not just this blanket case of where you go out and willy-nilly fire people out of their homes. This is something where you sit down, you negotiate. Some people may well be in a house they can't afford, but the principle of sitting down and saying, what is your financial situation and what can you afford? And then you're at that, this is the point where you sit and you say, when we've gone through this, you have an ability to carry, let's say you have a 300,000 mortgage, and they said you can carry principal and interest of 200,000. Then perhaps this concept that was introduced by the central bank that said you have a split mortgage and you have two elements. The first one, which is sustainable, the second part is put on the shelf. At the end of a period of time, if the property is sold, then that second part can be included in the repayment. But in the meantime, the occupants of homes, the mortgagees, should have the comfort and not the fear of every day that their house may be repossessed.
So should repossession be the absolute last resort?
Very, absolutely.
From Wednesday's late debate with Audrey Carvel, award-winning film and TV costume designer Joan Bergen was in studio with Catherine Thomas on The John Murray Show on Wednesday when she discussed dressing our First Lady for last week's state visit to Britain. She also told Catherine about her long-standing friendship with Sabina Higgins.
We met in Trinity at the Players Theatre. I wasn't at Trinity, but I was brought in, I think it was the Yeats plays, and I was one of the mournful women under the cross, I think, and she the more starring role. And then, of course, she was with Vocus Theatre at that time, and I joined, and, you know, there flourished a long friendship with Tom Hickey and Gabriel Byrne, all the people who were involved under David O'Connell.
So you remained close, very close throughout the years.
Yeah.
Did you always give her fashion advice? I mean, when you found...
Absolutely not. And I suppose that's the one area that when I entered into this, because I had planned the inauguration, which was the first time. But I think it's probably important to say it wasn't just a mate saying, you know, come on, you should wear blue. Like, I really went in as a professional costume designer to pull this whole look together. And as a result, I gained a lot because, you know, film is a very rarefied, very hardworking world. But you're, you know, you're dealing with Tudor kings or Vikings or something. And I was determined to go into shops and look and see what is available and spend a lot of time at that, then drag her in and out whenever she was free because she works terribly hard with Michael, our president.
But did she approach you or did you approach her? How did that happen?
She asked me, would I be involved? Mm-hmm. And in fact, because she's very meticulous, she was asking me for many months before I could even think about it. But I think I was looking out everywhere I was, you know.
And were there rules, royal rules, that were sent to you?
There was several wonderful kind of issues of protocol.
Go
but
on.
My amusing story around that is that, you know, I'm with the Kings of Essex at the moment. Last year I did the Kate Winslet-Rickman picture about Louis the 14th and then 4 years on the Tudors and then Windsor Castle looking out the bedroom windows. I thought, I'm living the reality.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
It's wonderful. Yeah.
How many outfits did you bring altogether or plan altogether?
We brought 14.
Okay.
And wore 12. We brought two Helen McLinden, really beautiful Donegal tweed suit, but the weather, beaming
glorious
blue skies.
Yeah.
So we were lucky right across the way, I think. And no, we'd one hysterical change in the vestry of Coventry Cathedral. Tried to change her. You know, I almost turned all the religious objects on the wall back to front. But she was, the actress in her, of course, just comes alive on those occasions.
And she's very able to deal
very
with all
able.
Those situations.
Very able.
What did they call you, by the way? Were you a lady in waiting,
well,
or were you?
The joke in the Ours was, in fact, that I was the lady of the bed chamber.
Joan Bergen talking to Catherine Thomas on The John Murray Show on Wednesday. Water was another subject which received lots of attention on air this week, particularly from the politicians assembled on last night's Callan's Kicks.
I know, I'll be spending the whole weekend in Petermark. I can't wait.
All right. This is going to be a very busy cabinet meeting. There's plenty on the agenda. So let's get started. First of all, we have
I have a glass of water before we start, please.
What did you say?
What? I just want a glass of water.
A glass of water. Just like that. Free.
Yes.
That's typical of you lefties. What? You want it all, don't you? You want of everything and pay for nothing.
It's just a glass of water, for goodness sake.
Water doesn't grow on trees, Gilmore.
Chill and fill.
But it's a basic human right.
This lad is far tastier, you know.
Well, I think we should take a stand.
Sit down, Thonish, or else you'll have to pay a standing charge now.
A standing? I didn't know anything about this.
You've known about it for 2 shagging years. Yes.
No, I didn't.
Because you're away from most of them. Even when he's at home, he only reads the World News and the Times.
Well, we Tory, Labour boys will not agree to it.
Sexist.
Hold on a second. Are you supporting this as well, Holland?
I will do whatever you tell me, master.
My humbuckle. Now get back to shining my shoes.
Yes, sir.
I want them so you can literally see Riley's arse when I ram it up his UHI plan.
Thanks, full, sir. Michael, I think I have a solution here. That
Shut
will
your mouth, Blandy. Let me handle it.
Yes, sir.
Here's what I'll give you, Labour lads.
Success.
5 days. Let's have a phony row for 5 days.
Yes.
Let them think you're trying your best.
2 weeks. I want a good run over Easter. Let the people think we're the government watchdog and we're not afraid to bite.
Yes.
Then we can do the usual thing after 2 weeks.
Done deal.
You have your 2 weeks. Then we'll just blame the Troika.
Who are only there because of what Fianna Fáil did to the mentals of the economy.
Yes. Fundamentals, Blandy.
Yes, keep stirring that pot while for the next week and a half.
Yes.
Tis pure unadulterated. Adulterated holidays! Who's your Easter daddy? Lift me up, lad, shoulder high.
Careful, don't touch my high. From last night's Callan's Kicks. Broadcaster John Kelly was a guest on the Today Show on Tuesday when he came in to talk about his newly published novel From Out of the City and some of the big words they like to use up in Fermanagh.
What about maybe your exploration of language or maybe experimentation there, John? I mean, using a word like pandiculation.
Oh, yes.
You better explain.
Well,
to
when
us
I
what
find a
means.
Word, when I find a word like pandiculation, I can't resist it. And that, I think, that in terms of influence, is definitely coming from Flann O'Brien, because you know he would have enjoyed a word like that and would have made good use of it. When we were kids growing up in Fermanagh, and then it occurs to me in later years that Flann O'Brien was from Tyrone, we talked like Flann O'Brien when we were messing. You know, that kind of language and that
like
kind
how?
Of, well, just that kind of surreal, heightened, absurdist language. We went on like that all the time. It came quite naturally to us, actually. Now, as we got older, we became more like Beckett. We realised nothing's going to happen here, ever.
You're very high opinion of yourselves up there,
oh,
don't
we
you?
Were. But when you're sitting underneath a lamppost and you know, one guy's just been spitting for 3 hours on the tarmac and you think, well, will we go home now? It's pretty Beckettian in its ways.
You have a day job, which has different strands to it. There's lyric and also there's your work with the art show on television now going out on Friday at 8:30 in the evening. So where does the writing fit in?
5 o'clock in the morning, mostly. Yeah, it's the only way you can do it. Which explains a lot about the book, actually, because when you're writing in a kind of an unconscious sort of a fugue at 5 o'clock in the morning and you haven't had your breakfast yet, you know, all sorts of stuff goes on in your brain and all sorts of stuff emerges. When you read it later that evening when you get home from work, you don't even remember.
From five until?
Well, until the kids get up, you know. So 5 until 7, 7:30, sometime around then, and then bedlam, and that's good night writer for a while.
On an empty stomach.
On an empty stomach.
John Kelly, as heard on the Today Show on Tuesday. Children of the Revolution is a programme presented by Joe Duffy, which is going out on Easter Monday on Radio 1 to remember the children who died during Easter 1916. Joe was a guest on last week's Fáilte Isteach with Angus McAnally when he spoke about how he first became interested in the subject.
It looks like there were at least 40 children aged 2 to 16 who were killed during Easter week. And the vast majority of them, Angus, between 34 and 36 of them, were killed in crossfire. And we will never know who shot them because, one, there was no inquests or coroner's reports in the mayhem that was that week, the chaos that was that week. Like, some of them were wheeled up to Glasnevin in handcarts to be buried.
It's awfully tragic. It could have been friendly fire. It could have been
crossfire.
Could have been ricochet.
Cannonading is one word that keeps popping up. That's from an explosion. They could remember, it was Easter Monday, the day after Easter. The excitement of Easter. The kids are off school. It was a lovely warm day. All the children that were killed were between the two canals. One of them was from outside Dublin visiting, but all of them were from within the two canals. The fighting breaks out down in O'Connor Street, up in Boland's Mills, up in Stephen's Green. What do kids do when they hear horses charging?
Run out on the street, have
they
a look.
Run. Especially then, because they lived on the street. They were all living in one room, a lot of them with 6 or 7 siblings. They all ran down to O'Connor Street, or ran down to Stephen's Green, or ran down to Mount Street Bridge.
And no sense of danger, probably.
No sense
either.
Of danger, because there'd been no history of it, you see. It's not as if there'd been a skirmish the previous year and the mothers would have known. One child, Christopher Cathcart, lived up in Charlemagne Street, was playing over the canal there, Portobello Bridge in Palmerston Park, which is still there. The shooting breaks out, one of the incidents was at Davies Pub at Portobello Bridge, and he sent for, come home quick, and he was about 8. He runs back, gets lost in the excitement or the melee or the chaos, and he's shot outside the pub accidentally. Then when I research his family, I discover that his brother, 2 years older than him, drowns in the canal, Angus, 2 years later. And his father dies 3 years later, 51, from a brain hemorrhage. So you get these awful vivid pictures of what life was like in Dublin.
Joe Duffy talking to Angus McAnally on Fáilte Isteach last Saturday. And that show, Children of the Revolution, can be heard on Radio 1 this coming Easter Monday. That's about my lot for this week. To play us out, I picked a piece performed by Irish musician Gavin Glass, which he's playing at a tribute to Leavon Helm of the Band in the Sugar Club in Dublin tonight. This is The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down. I'm Fiona Kelly. Emer Horgan is here next week. So until the next time, goodbye.
Virgil Cain is a name, and I served on the devil train. The storm was cavalry came. tore up the tracks again. Now in the winter of 65, we were hungry, we were barely alive. May 10th, Richmond fell. It's a time I remember oh so well. The night they drove old Dixie down, and the bells were ringing. The night they drove old Dixie down, the people were singing. They went na 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 na. Back with my wife in Tennessee, one day she calls to me. Now Virgil, quick, come see, there goes a rabbit E. Lee. But I don't mind chopping wood, no, I don't care if the money no good. Take what you need and you leave the rest. You should never. My brother below.